So, bit of an armchair expert, are you? All right, let's see what you've got.
Gloves on, detective, for Julia Zemiro's brand new show.
Which is a show all around crime, the whys, the wherefores, the whos and the what not to do's, obviously.
Two criminologists and two comedians each episode. Celia Pakola, Claire Hooper, Reese Nicholson and more. Because who better?
It'd be a crime to miss it.
Crime Night with Julia Zemiro starts Wednesday, November 5 on ABC TV and ABC iView.
As Prime Minister Anthony Albanese meets with world leaders at the ASEAN summit in Kuala Lumpur, US President Donald Trump is in the thick of his Asia trip and is preparing to meet with his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping in South Korea. We'll hear from a former US ambassador to the People's Republic of China about what's at stake for each leader.
I don't think it's going to be a typical trade deal, you know, 1,000 pages long, written by lawyers with all sorts of deadlines. It more likely is going to be a series of agreements on several issues.
Then, an apology from WA's governor for one of the most notorious attacks on Aboriginal peoples in Australian history.
It's long overdue, and we've had the traditional owners, the Bidjarup Noongar people, calling out for many, many years, asking for the truth to be told.
From the Radio National Breakfast team, this is The Breakfast Wrap. The US and China have agreed to a framework for a new trade deal just days before President Donald Trump is due to meet his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping in South Korea. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent has told America's CBS News that the agreement, which has been forged on the sidelines of the ASEAN summit in Malaysia, means the upcoming tariffs imposed on China are effectively off the table. For expert analysis on this, host Sally Sara spoke with former US ambassador to the People's Republic of China, Nicholas Burns.
How substantive do you expect this agreement to be between China and the US?
Well, I think it's positive news that they've agreed because these are the two largest global economies. We all want to see global stability and markets, and so a good step forward. But it's unclear what type of trade deal this is going to be. I don't think it's going to be a typical trade deal, you know, 1,000 pages long, written by lawyers with all sorts of deadlines. It more likely is going to be a series of agreements on several issues, on TikTok, on fentanyl, which is a major problem here in the U.S. The precursor chemicals for fentanyl come from the black market in China. Certainly on agricultural purchases by China. China is the largest market for U.S. agriculture. So issues like that. And then hopefully, as Secretary Bessent was saying, that China will not go forward with its export controls on rare earth, and the United States will not go forward with its 100% additional tariffs on top of the ones that already exist. It's almost like a truce, an uneasy truce in a trade war that I think will likely continue after this meeting.
Nicholas, what do you think is at stake for each leader here?
I think the Chinese will certainly insist that Xi Jinping be seen as someone who got as well as he gave. And the same is true of President Trump. And so that's why it's taken so long for Vice Premier Hurley Fung, the Chinese negotiator, and our Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent to work out what appears to be a deal that both can live with. But it will leave many issues unresolved and to be, you know, discussed, debated, fought over the ensuing months.
How do you see the situation more broadly, Nicholas? We have heard the narrative of a United States which has been unpredictable, somewhat chaotic, difficult to read, and that China was positioning itself as a more predictable and stable global nation. How do you see that?
Well, certainly the President Trump's tariff policies have unleashed a wave of uncertainty around the world. There's no question about that. I would say the Chinese are trying to present themselves as the responsible party. But again, this is the country that, or the government, I should say, that for decades, China has been engaged in intellectual property theft against international companies like Australian and American companies, forced technology transfer. And so it hasn't been a reliable custodian of global trade rules. And both of them have rolled out these big bazookas of announcements of big tariffs on the other. And that's where I think both have decided to back down a little bit this week because, you know, both countries need stability as well.
How would you describe the current political and economic situation inside China right now?
Well, the Chinese economy has been slowing down. It's now growing below 5%. It has for the past few years. And that's a concern for the leadership. They have the property crisis, still 80 million vacant apartments because of that bubble that was created several years ago. They have a major problem with youth unemployment and an additional problem of a demographic cliff, given the very alarmingly for the Chinese low rates of birth. And so I think they're worried a lot about that. And China is, of course, a manufacturing company and an export country. So I think it wants stability.
And Nicholas, we're seeing a lot more engagement between Europe and Australia as Europe has some concerns about protecting its trade routes into the Asia Pacific and Southeast Asia in particular. How's that viewed by China?
I think the Chinese are worried about it. It was clear from a trade perspective, human rights perspective, and a military perspective that the EU and NATO countries have begun to think over the last several years very strategically about their interests in the Asia-Pacific region. So, for example, they've been much more outspoken in Brussels, NATO and the EU, about their opposition to what China is doing in Taiwan, trying to intimidate the Taiwan authorities. The Europeans have joined Australia, the United States, and other countries in sanctions against Chinese entities that have violated international law, including Chinese companies selling dual-use technology to Russia for its war effort in Ukraine. The Europeans have been very vocal opponents of what they believe are, and we agree with them, human rights violations by the government of China in Xinjiang, Tibet, Hong Kong, the lack of religious freedom. So it's quite striking to me to see not just Australia, Japan, the United States, India, South Korea all cooperate together, but to see the Europeans rather decisively find their voice and believe that they've got to be involved in these issues as well. Another example of this is we've had British, French, German warships transit peacefully in international waters, the Taiwan Strait, as Australia, the United States, other countries have done routinely for a generation. So that is a trend line that the Chinese have been very worried about.
Nicholas Burns, former US ambassador to the People's Republic of China and now professor of the practice of diplomacy and international relations at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government, speaking with Sally there. To domestic politics now, and a warning, this following story mentions child sexual abuse. The ABC has revealed pedophiles are using the dark web to share information about how to gain access to childcare centres to sexually abuse babies and toddlers while avoiding getting caught. A Four Corners investigation has uncovered private forums where predators coach each other and post proof of their abuse. Earlier this year, federal, state and territory education leaders rolled out a series of reforms to protect children. But do these measures go far enough? Sally asked that very question to recently appointed Shadow Education and Early Learning Minister Julian Lisa.
What do you make of this latest investigation into the childcare sector by journalist Adele Ferguson? If pedophiles are sharing tips on how to infiltrate childcare centres, is the problem even bigger than we initially thought?
I think when you had instances of a husband and wife couple who were running a childcare centre who were pedophiles, where you had a man who said that he wanted to have a child in order to be able to abuse that child. When you saw the coaching of people online as to how to enter these childcare centres, it was just chilling. We have to have an environment where people know that their kids are going to be safe. This is the most precious people in the entire world to parents. And we need to do everything we can to ensure that that the families are safe. And we've offered bipartisan support for measures that the government has brought forward in the past, and we continue to do that. And I've written to the minister again this morning following this report. We introduced a piece of legislation in the last couple of weeks talking about mandatory minimum sentences for child sex offenders who produce and distribute material online. We call on the government to consider this and to pass this, because we've got to get these people off the streets, and we've got to make sure our children are protected, and we'll consider any reasonable measures.
These dark web forums where pedophiles are trading information give an insight into how organised and strategic these predators have become. How do we combat this kind of systemic problem?
We have people in Australia who are expert in these things, in the Australian Centre for Countering Child Exploitation. We have a range of civil society organisations who are following people. But we need to ensure that we're giving law enforcement adequate tools. We need to ensure that the childcare regulators have the tools that they need as well. And that's why I've written again to the Minister this morning to offer our support, because this just can't be allowed to continue, and we need to throw the book at these people, and we need to ensure that we're throwing every resource to weed people out of the system and to bring people who are engaging in child sexual exploitation on the web or the dark web to justice.
Does the opposition support a national childcare commission to oversee the sector?
I think we've got to look at every available alternative here, Sally, because The prime duty that we all have in this building is to guarantee the safety of children, and so we've got to consider all options. And if it's a sensible option and a reasonable option, then I think we should consider it.
A Western Sydney childcare centre has announced it will suspend operations to rebuild its staff team from the ground up days after two workers were charged with allegedly assaulting a child. What are parents' options in these circumstances?
It's very difficult for parents who are looking to send their children to childcare centres. We know there are shortages of childcare places in different areas. I read the report of the centre at Doonside this morning, and there's a family there who'd been looking to get into a childcare centre and had found this particular place. I think we do need to have a look again at the way the whole system is structured. I think we need to ensure that parents have got proper choice. Parents know best how to raise their kids. Parents know what is best for their children. And I think it's incumbent on us to create choices for parents to ensure that they can ensure that their kids are safe.
On another matter, the government is pushing ahead with its plan to overhaul Australia's environmental laws. The business community has been critical of the Coalition's efforts to split the bill. Does the Coalition need to pay more attention to what the business community is seeking here?
Our job in these issues is to judge what's in the national interest here, and my colleague Angie Bell and Susan Lee have together written to the Minister calling on the bill to be split, because while we want to see environmental reform, or we want to ensure that we have proper environmental protection in Australia, we also need to balance that against the productivity of the country. The productivity forum that the government held was a reminder that the way in which projects are taking such a long time to get approved has become a real issue here, and that's why we offered to split the bill, which is what we did when we were in government. One looking at the approvals process, and the other looking at the more contentious matters. If we're going to deliver on projects like the critical minerals project that the Prime Minister and President Trump agreed to in the last couple of weeks, we've got to have a system which allows for projects to get up and running.
The Liberal Party is having multiple meetings this week about its policy on net zero. What on earth is going on?
We are going through a process where after an election where we lost, after two elections on the trot where we lost 30 seats, we're reviewing our policies. And Dan Tehan has put together a process where everybody's going to have a chance to have their say, and we'll resolve on a policy direction after that time based on our values. But at the same time, under this government, emissions are going up, prices are going up, and reliability is going down.
Can you be an effective opposition so many months out from the election without a policy?
It's only 5 months since the last election, and this is a sort of Bismarck laws and sausages moment. We are looking at our new direction, and we're having a debate and people are expressing different views. That's exactly what you want in a democracy. But we will resolve the right outcome that's good for our country.
Julian Lisa, Shadow Minister for Education and Early Learning, speaking with Sally in studio there. And if you or someone you know needs support, help is available through 1800 RESPECT or Bravehearts on 1800 272 831. To Western Australia now, and a warning, the following story includes details of violence against Indigenous peoples. Today marks 191 years since the Pinjarra massacre in WA, one of the most notorious attacks on First Nations peoples in Australian history. In 1834, a detachment of soldiers, police and settlers, led by then State Governor James Stirling, ambushed a group of Binjarrub Noongar people. Between 15 and 20 lost their lives, according to original records, but elders say that number is much higher. Ahead of making an official apology for the actions of his predecessors, Sally spoke with the Governor of WA, His Excellency the Honourable Chris Dawson.
Why have you decided to issue a formal apology?
Well, one, because it's the right thing to do, to tell the truth. It's long overdue, and we've had the traditional owners, the Binjarrub Noongar people, calling out for many, many years, asking for the truth to be told. And I think in context, Governor Stirling, when he did report on this tragedy, he described it as a skirmish. And over the years, it's been also commonly described as a battle. But in more latter years, it has been better described as to what it was, and that was a massacre.
Where does this sit in WA's history since colonisation?
Well, it's a marker where after 5 years of colonial settlement, there had been conflict clearly over land. Governor Stirling was allocating land to the first settlers. That was, of course, land that was already occupied by the traditional owners. So, one, there was a contest over land, but two, there was a contest over food sources, because the natural food sources being, you know, kangaroos, possums, emus, etc., were being used as a food source by both, obviously, Aboriginal people and the settlers. And then, of course, when livestock started getting speared and stolen and taken, that led to reprisal attacks on both sides. There were killings on both sides, and it got to a point in 1834 where clearly Governor Stirling was being lobbied, and so he took it upon himself to have an armed group of 25 go down and, in his words, put a check and punish this particular tribe.
What do you hope that this apology will achieve?
It's a really important step. I don't think we can wrap a ribbon around this and say, well, look, it's all done now. I know there will be commentators and people that will say, you're just looking back and we need to look forward. I agree with that. We need to look forward, but we can't forget. And the call and the invitation I've got from the traditional owners has been a long call saying, please tell the truth. Just acknowledge that this was wrong. And yes, it was in a state of early colonial history, and so we shouldn't forget it. What I'm hoping is that this is an important step to just put that line there to say that shouldn't have happened like this. No one was put to trial. There were innocent people who were caught up in this, and we'll never know the precise number. But from this, I'm hoping that we will have healing and that this will lead to growth. And so we're going to exchange, actually, some very symbolic trees, which I'm happy to explain.
What's happening with that?
Well, Governor Stirling, when he was living at Government House in Perth, planted an European olive tree. And as I walked around the gardens, and you know, it's quite a famous tree in our gardens, it's alive and well today, some 190 years later. And I thought, well, how can we symbolise this? Well, the olive branch internationally, a sign of peace. I thought about, well, why don't I offer them an olive branch in the form of a young sapling, which we are going to do. But the Aboriginal people responded to me and said, well, we'll give you a eucalyptus jarrah and we can plant that in each other's places. And I think the symbolism of this is a really important symbol because they're both strong trees. They can both put deep roots down, but they can grow on the same soil, that is Australia, and both live side by side, as they do as trees, and we need to do that with all Australians. And this is, I think, an important opportunity to say, let's build on this truth, acknowledge the past, but then let's grow together. It's a really important step. And I've listened to people like Pat Dodson, and you know, to quote Pat, he said that our foundations were built on non-truths or only partial truths or stories from one side. Challenges we now need to rebuild on truths more clearly so we can share and celebrate what we all hold in common. And that, I think, is the absolute aim for today, is that as Australians, we grow together and go forward.
The Governor of Western Australia, His Excellency the Honourable Chris Dawson, speaking with Sally there. And if this story has raised issues for you, you can call the 24-hour Indigenous National Crisis Hotline, 13YARN, that's 139276. Now for today's final segment, and this one goes out to all the stargazers. The Swan Reach Conservation Park in South Australia is home to the country's only dark sky reserve, which sees thousands of stargazers visit each year. Now there are plans for a new planetarium and observatory, albeit with a multi-million dollar price tag. For more on this, Sally spoke with Chris Tugwell, who's the founder of the Dark Sky Reserve and a key proponent of the new development.
Now let's start off with the basics here, Chris. What is a dark sky reserve?
The River Murray Dark Sky Reserve is actually nearly 3,500 square kilometres. So it's enormous. And it includes about a dozen small townships in the region. And that area is now protected from light pollution. It's one of the darkest places in the world, really. I mean, Australia is very dark because of the vast expanses of desert and land. Our dark sky reserve is the darkest close to a major city. So we're only 90 minutes northeast of Adelaide, and that means that people can fly in from cities where you can't see the stars at all. Mm-hmm. They can be in a dark sky reserve and experience something they've never seen in their lives.
Where are people travelling from to come and make the most of this dark sky reserve in SA?
Well, it's amazing, actually, because when we started off, which was just before COVID, people were coming from just local areas because they didn't realise that they lived somewhere really special. Now we're beginning to get people from interstate and overseas and, you know, really expanding that that interest.
And what sort of facilities are there? Is it a case of people being able to look up with the naked eye, or they bring their own telescopes, or are there facilities there to make the most of all of this?
Well, it's a lot of big open space at the moment. Our motto is just look up. You don't need lots of fancy equipment, but, you know, if you do happen to go on a tour with an astronomer, that can really just enhance the experience for you.
Do a lot of families bring their kids in to get a taste of what's up there?
Interest from young people is really amazing. And just as an example, the Cambray Primary School, which is one of the schools that is inside the reserve, some of their students went to the National ANCAIR Conference in the Gold Coast a couple of weeks ago, and one of them spoke about the Dark Sky Reserve at that conference. Can you? And, you know, that's how much they're engaged and interested. Mm. They know now that they live somewhere special.
Was there any kind of scepticism from the locals when this terminology and this proposal was initially being thrown around, Chris?
I thought there would be more, in fact, but the local community and the local council have been incredibly supportive. They can see it as a huge opportunity for the region. It gives people a chance to think about a career that isn't necessarily in farming, but they can become a scientist, an astronomer, and stay in the region and, you know, do proper research.
And what are the standards or requirements that you need to meet to maintain this status as a dark sky reserve?
It's like World Heritage listing. I think that's the simplest way to think about it. And we need to do an annual report for the for Dark Sky International, the body that accredits these places. And when we did our first application, we had to actually measure the darkness. I didn't know you could do that. I'm not a scientist, in fact. I'm not even an astronomer. I'm a writer. We've had darkness readings in our area of 21.9, and that's on a scale that goes from 0 to 22. So it's absolutely at the darkest end of the scale.
Chris Tugwell, founder of the Dark Sky Reserve, speaking with host Sally Sara there. You can hear more interviews like that every morning from 5:30 a.m. on Radio National and find the breakfast wrap after that. Every interview was produced by the ABC Radio National Breakfast team, while the breakfast wrap was produced by Michael Kermont. I'm Lexi Junowick. Catch you tomorrow.